It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Despite reporting millions in political spending, a brand new super PAC doesn't seem to actually exist. We'll talk with the reporter who tried to track it down about what it shows us about our campaign finance system. That's ahead here on the Ideas Network. First, as businesses slowly begin to reopen, workers will transition from either unemployment or working from home back to the regular routines of our jobs. But we've had time to think, and we've been forced to do things differently. While some are eager to get back to the way that we've always done things, others are wondering if this is a chance to do it differently. Will COVID-19 change the way we work? Has it made some flaws in our attitudes toward work more obvious? Phyllis Moen helps us answer those questions. She holds the McKnight Presidential Chair in Sociology at the University of Minnesota. She studies occupational careers, gender, families, and well-being over the life course. Phyllis is also the author of several books, including her latest, which is co-written with Aaron Kelly. It's called Overload: How Good Jobs Went Bad and What We Can Do About It. Phyllis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start with people who are working from home, because regardless of whether they're finding it enjoyable or beneficial, we now know that it's possible to do lots of work remotely. What do you think people are realizing now?
Absolutely. This has been a sea change in the way we work. 7% prior to COVID-19 were able to work at home. Not that they all did. Now 60% of the workforce is working from home. So this is really different. And what workers are finding is that in some way, there are good things and bad things about working from home.
So what are some of them then? What are people realizing about the opportunities that can find when they don't have to go into the office?
They love getting rid of the commute, getting rid of getting dressed up anyway, and having the ability potentially to better manage work and family responsibilities. What they don't like is that, in a way, instant access has become the new FaceTime, that people expect you to be always on, to respond immediately to emails, to take every Zoom call. And this can be very frustrating in terms of getting your work done as well as at managing those kids that are invariably around.
Sure, you should be able to take my call. What else are you doing right now? You're just at home.
Yes, absolutely. So we have the clash of old rules and new realities, and they don't mix very well.
Do we know what employers are seeing when people are working from home and how they're managing expectations that way?
Yeah, employers are finding that people can be more productive. And that is going to, I believe, lead to at least different ways of working, including hybrid work arrangements. So some days may be at the workplace and other days working remotely. They also are seeing that it's difficult to manage employers remotely. They're having to rethink their routines and their expectations about how and when work is done.
And when it comes to some of the opportunities, I think that, you know, workers are finding, you mentioned there's a sort of flexibility in trying to manage the different aspects of our lives. I can imagine a future where we are expected to be back in offices all the time, where people are expected to be back at work. And then that flexibility kind of goes away, or people are going to have to negotiate to try to keep that intact. Do you think that will be widespread, or is that just a case by case sort of a situation?
I think people have tasted a new way of working, and this is going to make going back to old ways seem virtually impossible. But, you know, in our study, when we looked at people who worked at home, they had reduced stress, more job satisfaction, they were less likely to turn over, but it was because they were choosing to work at home. The difference now is this is imposed by the employer and by the state, so that it may have positive effects and may have negative effects. What I hope we move to is where people have greater discretion and choice about where and when they work and more control over those things.
Do you think that's reasonable? You say you hope we move to that, but do you think that employers and employees can work together and figure that out?
in a randomized field trial we did in a Fortune 500 company that we talk about in our book, that we found exactly that. And it really, as I say, reduced stress, enhanced general feelings of well-being. People exercised more, they slept more, they were more in control of their time. The dirty secret is that the way we currently work, or at least the way we worked before COVID-19, is really unsustainable. It's unsustainable for creativity and performance at work, and it's definitely unsustainable for workers' health and well-being.
We can talk more about that in just a moment. We're talking with Phyllis Moen, who studies careers, gender, families, and lifelong well-being. And you're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about working from home versus going back to the office? How have you experienced work under COVID-19? And what does it have you thinking about when things go, I guess, for lack of a better term, back to normal? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. And your new book that's coming out that you've co-authored, called Overload, How Good Jobs Went Bad and What We Can Do About It, that's a lot to pack into one title. Where do you see some of the overlap in research for that book and the conversations you've been having in this pandemic?
Yeah, it's working at home. It's working differently. And what we found and what I see today is the need to clarify expectations, to really step back. Employers and their managers and their teams need to step back and think, what are the tasks that are really necessary? What is value added? Is a particular meeting necessary, or has it just become routine with no reasonable agenda? How can we really reassess expectations as well as timelines? We've been working often under impossible deadlines. Everything seems to be due yesterday. And can we rethink and reappraise these deadlines so that we're not always doing fire drills? We're not always having to multitask and split our attention five different ways.
All of that makes sense when we're talking about it from a worker's perspective, but I could see employers saying, you know, yes, this is the way we've always done it, but there's also a reason for it, and I know it's hard, and we just have to keep doing it because there's no better option. So how do you deal with the employer side of that when they are sometimes less likely to make adjustments?
I think if they can see, and they are seeing from this work at home social experiment that we're doing, they can see that employees do perform better. They're more creative. They have time to hit the pause button and be more creative and more responsive in terms of the tasks that are needed to do. But employers are also going to have to really think about new performance metrics so that it shouldn't be that the person in the office the longest, who gets there before the manager and leaves after the manager leaves, is seen as the good worker, the valued worker. Instead, we're going to have to think about results, not time. What are we really about in this organization and in this team? What should we get done? And decide on key the mission-driven tasks, such as developing reasonable deadlines and figuring out what constitutes reaching the objectives that they desire.
Greg from Sheboygan wants to join the conversation. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I work at a place in Sheboygan, and it's a meat processing plant, Wisconsin. It's a really nice place. I love it. But I won't go back to work because I have COPD and I'm 66. But I used to be a biochemist. And I worked on a couple of things that they were worried about becoming epidemics, Legionnaires' disease, and also the Keystone virus and the mosquitoes. And I was a biochemist at Walter Reed. And in Walter Reed's the guy with the malaria, so I did malaria studies, and I jumped into Leishmania and all sorts of different things. But I can tell you exactly how the only way we can conquer this disease, and it's just stupidly simple. They manufactured an antibody and an antigen test, and the antigen test isn't as accurate as the antibody, but the antibody takes longer. But we have to, every single lab that can make them, if you give me the reagents, I can make it. But anybody who can make it must make these tests, and we must stop everyone from leaving their homes for one full day and test everyone.
All right. Thanks for that, Greg. And what I heard Greg say at the very beginning, other than the stay home at the end, is just that, you know, Greg works at a meat processing plant. Phyllis, we've been talking a lot about offices, but factories and plants, they present a different kind of situation when it comes to figuring out what the expectations are from here on out. Do you think work in those places changes, too?
I hope it does, because it's unsustainable the way it is. In a lot of these workplaces, the schedules are set on the Friday before the following week. So people are not able to plan for a dentist appointment or going to their child's sports activity. We need to rethink and give people more predictability about when they're going to work for those who cannot work remotely. So predictability is important, and supportive supervisors are important, as well as what Greg is talking about, good healthcare practices.
We're talking with Phyllis Moen, the McKnight Presidential Chair in Sociology at the University of Minnesota, and we're talking about how COVID-19 could change our attitudes and our expectations of work. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Maybe you've been working adjusted hours or working from home because of COVID-19. Are you thinking about asking to continue that schedule after the pandemic, after the health scare has been mitigated? What do you like about your currently changed schedule? Or maybe you've been unable to work. So will your expectations of your employer change when you have to go back? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about what work looks like as we get a handle on COVID-19 and put people back in offices and stores and classrooms. Sociologist Phyllis Moen is our guest as we figure out how this pandemic might or might not change the way we work and the way we feel about our work. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you hope changes about your job as we emerge from this pandemic? Do you wish that you had more flexibility at work, or maybe you're unable to work right now? Are you thinking you just want to get back to normal, or maybe you'd like to see some changes now that you've had time to go over it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we just talked about processing plants, things like that. But, of course, workers in those plants, in manufacturing, retail, restaurant work, a lot of those people can't work from home. It's just not an option. Do you think that our attitudes about that kind of work have changed at all in this pandemic, Phyllis?
I hope so. I think we're seeing that many of these workers are essential to our way of life, and we're valuing them in different ways. But they, too, often experience overload. There's too few staff, and demands are ratcheted up, so they have too much to do and too little time to do it. Too few working colleagues that are there. We've cut our workforce in many places to the bone and expect others to work smart and to do more with less. But you can't do more with less continually. It's simply not sustainable. One thing we could do is rethink what is really necessary work and get rid of the things that aren't necessary, like the report that no one reads or the meeting that where nothing important is ever discussed, to rethink so that we can trim down the sheer amount of work that people have to do.
People tend to sacrifice a lot for their jobs, especially when we're going into those places. You know, our world revolves around work, and that's many days a week. And right now it seems like we are trying to do our work, but also putting more time focused on our family or our personal time. Is that something that you think will be sustainable, or will employers, you know, eventually say that was fine for the moment, but now we need you back here and we need you focused?
I think that we can't go back to old ways of doing things. There will be a new normal. What it is, we can't see. What I would like to see is for us to reimagine and redesign how work is done, where and when work is done in the current crisis, but also beyond it. Getting rid of low-value work, thinking about how people communicate and when they communicate, and working as a team with managers to figure out how best to meet the objectives of the firm, but also to have time for themselves and time for their families. One thing we've learned from this crisis is that, in fact, what we've always secretly known but not officially recognized is that people have families and personal lives. This is really obvious now when a child goes across the screen when you're Zooming or a dog barks. People have lives, and work is going to have to be arranged differently to recognize the need for time out, both for recreation, for family, but also simply for mental health.
Phyllis Moen studies careers, gender, families, and lifelong well-being. And we're taking your calls as we talk about what work looks like and how it changes because of the way we're figuring out how to work during this pandemic. There's still time for you at 800-642-1234. You can also share your story, your experience, or your questions with us at ideas@WPR.org. Phyllis, you mentioned employees working with managers as a team, and I wonder how you would recommend a worker start a conversation if they can point out, you know, that work that really doesn't have a big return and bring it up to a manager and say, hey, can we do this differently? How do you approach those situations from the worker standpoint?
I think it would be best if one talked to the team and the manager as well, as simply asking questions such as, what are the costs of the current practices, the way we used to work before COVID-19? The idea that there are costs to doing that. There are health costs, but there's also the quality of the work suffers when people are asked to do too much and too little time. Asking what is being rewarded today, and are those the tasks and the traits that actually matter? What gets it rewarded is often long hours on the job, either online or before the crisis in one's seat at work. Is that what we really want to measure, or are there other things that matter? So developing new performance appraisals. What is really valued, not simply time in the office or time online?
And you encourage us to have those kinds of conversations and evaluate it.
Absolutely. And if there's little response, at least then rethink what you yourself are doing and how you could maybe change at minimum your way of thinking. So, for instance, to not think of long hours as a badge of honor. You know, we all say we come in, used to come in, but even now say, well, I worked all weekend, as if this is a positive thing. We need to rethink our mindsets and reevaluate how we think and equate time with good work. They're not necessarily the same. And think about when, where, and how you work best. What are the conditions? All of us can think about and remember when we do our best work. It's usually when we're not constantly interrupted. So how can you create spaces to have time to not be interrupted? Constant interruptions are antithetical to good work. And figure out how you can trim unnecessary work in your own job, without official policies. Maybe don't accept every call and meeting automatically, but ask, am I really needed on this call? Is this something that I can contribute to or not? And support coworkers in their lives, and they will support you. We're all in this together. How can we work differently, supporting one another as whole people, not just as workers? And change routines to fit your family and personal life if necessary. Right now, we've sacrificed well, before COVID-19, I should say, we sacrificed everything, family, health, to the job. I don't think people are willing to go back to that again.
All right, and we just have a few moments left, and we've got Dennis from Two Rivers who wants to talk with us. Hey, Dennis.
Hi, Phyllis. I just heard you mention something about a new normal, and I just wonder, with all the changes we're going through, how do we know when we've reached a new normal?
Oh, fair question, Dennis. We know we're in a time of transition now, but how do we know when we land there, Phyllis?
I think when you see the way we work changing, someone said, one CEO that we talked to said, the normal here is the way we work is at work. And he wanted long hours, but he also wanted people to be on a call on the weekends. When these rules change, when people stop expecting 24/7 accessibility, we'll know we're at a new normal. When people have flexibility that isn't mother may I accommodation, like can I particularly have this time off, but that work time is not considered the metric, but the means of getting work done. And when it's not seen as having negative career consequences to take time out for your family or personal life, then we'll know we're at a new normal.
All right, Phyllis, thank you so much for explaining your perspective and your research with us today.
Thank you.
Phyllis Moen holds the McKnight Presidential Chair in Sociology at the University of Minnesota, and she studies occupational careers, gender, families, and well-being over the course of life. She's also the author of several books, including her latest, which is co-written with Aaron Kelly. It's called Overload: How Good Jobs Went Bad and What We Can Do About It. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about one reporter's attempt to track down the money behind a super PAC that doesn't actually seem to exist. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the newest Marquette University Law School poll is out today. We'll look at how people in Wisconsin feel about the coronavirus, how our elected leaders are handling the response, and the race for president, and more. First, political action committees are behind a chunk of the political advertising we see on TV and online. We call them PACs, and despite handling millions of dollars in an election year, they're able to keep much of their funding anonymous. One new super PAC, called Americans for Progressive Action USA, reported $2.5 million in spending to the Federal Elections Commission. But after trying to follow that money, our guest was hard-pressed to find anyone who'd gotten paid by the group or even heard of it. Zach Montalero is a campaign reporter for Politico. Zach, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Political action committees, more or less a fact of our political life right now. We hear about them often. So before we get into this strange tale, remind us what a PAC or super PAC actually is. Who or what makes it up?
Yeah, so there are actually two different things. A PAC and a super PAC are similar but related. A PAC is a group of people, sometimes tied to a politician, sometimes not, that can spend on elections, but they have a limit. They can only raise $5,000, give or take, depending on the election, from individuals. A super PAC is kind of like that, but supercharged, basically. Super PACs can collect an unlimited amount of money from individuals, from labor unions, from corporations. They do have to disclose their donors on either monthly or quarterly basis to the Federal Election Commission, but there's really no restrictions on what they can spend and whom they can take money from. If it's an American or an American company, they can take the money. If it's a foreign company or a foreign national, they can't. But other than that, they can just take in millions and millions of dollars from whoever they want.
And where can they spend it?
So they can spend it on basically whatever they want related to elections. That's television advertising, radio advertising, paying to come knock on your door, paying for polling. There's really very little limits on what they can do. What they can't do is they can't coordinate directly with campaigns. So if I'm running for the Senate, I can't have a super PAC that I directly coordinate with. That rule has been stretched a lot. Sometimes you see super PACs and organizers of super PACs tweeting things that are very clearly messages to campaigns or vice versa, but they can't just pick up the phone and call the campaign and say, I would like you to do so-and-so.
The title of your article for Politico is The Bizarro Tale of a Phantom Super PAC and Our Sleuthing to Find It. Bizarro really does describe what you found about Americans for Progressive Action USA. When did you realize something was strange with this particular group?
Yeah, so I, for a hobby, I suppose, I look at a lot of campaign finance reports. It's what I do for fun. Take that for what you will. But what really caught my interest with that was this was a group I had never heard of, and I'm fairly familiar with a lot of these groups. And about 2 weeks ago at this point, they reported on back-to-back days spending $2.5 million on about a half dozen competitive Senate races. That's a lot of money. It's not a huge amount of money in elections. $2.5 million won't get you the whole world. But this early in a race, this far out, that's a significant chunk. And I tried to do some digging, tried to figure out who they were, what they did. And the long story short is that nobody's ever heard of this group. I talked to about a dozen Democratic operatives who are kind of in this universe, who work on these Senate races, and campaign finance experts. No one has heard of it. And more confusingly, the folks listed as vendors for these groups, that the folks at this super PAC reported to the federal government saying that this is who we spent the money with, said that they have no record of this group, they've never heard of this group, and they're pretty sure the group doesn't exist, actually.
And these aren't just like random individuals that would have been paid for things. You're talking about companies like Verizon, Facebook, Google.
Yeah, so it was kind of split into three groups. It was the three major tech companies, Verizon, Facebook, Google, that accounted for about a third of that reported spending, about $800,000. And there was Facebook and Google, both publicly maintained databases that you can go look at online with political ads running on their platforms. You know, they're not the most intuitive in the universe, but they're usable, and there's no evidence of that spending. And Verizon actually got back and said, yep, we've never heard of this group. They did not spend all this money with us. The second group is kind of established political vendors, people who are well-known in the organization, well-known in the Democratic universe, who are running television ads, creating these ads. Reached out to them. They, too, had never heard of them. They said pretty definitively, this is not our client. We were not paid the money by this group because we've never heard of this group. We have no idea who these folks are. Then the third group, which is the one I couldn't track down, was a couple of vendors that by all from all accounts do not appear to actually exist. They allegedly spent this money on vendors that aren't registered with the federal government, that aren't registered with the D.C. government as being a business incorporated here, that have no other past records of working in the FEC, and really, from what, as far as I could tell, have no actual presence and may not actually exist.
So did you have any luck then finding out even who was involved in running or funding Americans for Progressive Action USA?
Yeah, so that's the confusing part. It's not really. So one gentleman by the name of Evan Jones is listed on public records as being the treasurer for the group. So the treasurer for a super PAC is the person basically responsible for keeping the books. Some organizations, the treasurer is also the person who actually does the spending. I emailed him. I called him. His phone number listed in public records, which you by law have to put correct information in, was disconnected, did not respond after the first email I sent to him. So none for that. The donors are also public, but we were not able to personally track down and identify the donors. But even they were a little confusing. Committees have to report, and that's both for super PACs, regular PACs, and actual campaign committees, have to report anybody who donates over $200 to the Federal Election Commission on a regular basis, be it every month for some groups or every 3 months for most groups. The donors they had listed, I could find no evidence of them actually existing on the internet, which, you know, it's not unusual. Individuals, especially those who could theoretically be giving millions of dollars, may not want to be tracked. But they also have to list their occupation. And I told the group listed as an occupation for one of these donors, the ACLU, the Civil Liberties Organization. And they said that person by that name both didn't work for their Texas organization, which is where that person reported to have lived, and didn't work for their national organization. So, I couldn't definitively track down these donors, which in and of itself was kind of interesting, but the information I could try to verify did not come back as true.
Zach Montalero is a campaign reporter for Politico, and we're talking about some research that he's done digging into a new PAC that doesn't seem to actually exist, even though it's filed filings with the Federal Elections Commission. And this is Central Time. Zach, this is certainly strange, although it is true, false filings and scams do happen, but they're usually different from what's happening here, right?
Yeah. So, there's the false filings, which happen not infrequently. that kind of represent usually a joke candidate, one that may not be appropriate to say on the radio.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes think of somebody like Batman. Batman is quite frequently running for president. Obviously, Batman is not running for president. It's normally some kid just kind of putting a filing, joking in, and it's one and done. And there's also this other universe of scam packs. Scam packs do everything legitimately through the FEC. They report accurate information to the Federal Election Commission. What they're doing is kind of misrepresenting what they actually do. A traditional scam pack would represent itself as kind of fighting for a pretty globally, you know, amenable cause, saying I'm fighting for cancer patients. I'm advocating on behalf of police officers and firefighters. What they actually end up doing is that these scam packs say that they're raising money on behalf of these groups, but then that money, almost the entirety of it, ends up back in the pockets of the people organizing the pack. So they'll say, please, they'll send you a letter. They'll call you up saying, just give us a $10 donation, a $5 donation to help represent firefighters in Washington, D.C. What they'll actually do is they'll take 95%, 99% of your donation and donations of thousands of other people, and that kind of goes back into their pockets, and they'll do almost no political work. But this super PAC, Americans for Progressive Action USA, doesn't seem to fall into that category either, because they seem to have filed a fake report, and there's no evidence that they're actually raising money from small-dollar people. They're not calling up you, your listeners, your mother, your father, asking for small dollars. That what this super PAC reported to have done was take money from millionaires who are not normally the target for scam PACs either. So it's kind of different in that aspect as well.
So do we have any sense then why this PAC made the filing with the FEC without actually spending any money?
Yeah, so that's the thing. Out of the dozen or so people I talked to, everyone had their own theory for potentially why. The one I found most convincing, and since we couldn't actually reach the PAC, it's merely a theory, but the one I found most convincing is trying to show some level of influence in D.C. You know, spending money on behalf of elected officials will not guarantee you a meeting with a politician, but it certainly will help doing it, right? And a lot of people won't go through the extra step of actually checking, hey, did these ads run? Did this person actually support my election? So a theory that was floated that this group could potentially be looking to try to get some level of influence in Washington, or could be a fairly elaborate prank. It'd be kind of a lot of work for an elaborate prank, because this filing was not like those joke candidates. There was quite a few levels of sophistication in this that regular people just wouldn't know how to do. So that our best working theory was that this is someone trying to find some level of influence, and that they're not going to get it at this point.
Wow. So even under normal circumstances, though, a PAC is only required to disclose so much information. What kinds of things can they effectively keep confidential legally?
Yeah, so super PACs can they can keep some interesting things confidential. So under law, super PACs, party committees, basically anyone you give money to for a political campaign that's regulated by the FEC has to disclose the name and address and occupation of anyone who gives over $200. That's true for Joe Biden's campaign, for President Trump's campaign. That's true for these super PACs. But what they do, they disclose it on a fairly irregular basis. It's either every month for these super large ones, or every quarter. And they don't have to disclose their spending in the most minute detail. What a lot of these super PACs do is that they give all their money to one particular vendor, and that vendor ends up having sub-vendors and things like that. A kind of concerning thing that's come up recently as well, too, is the rise of gray money. Super PACs are not dark money. Super PACs do have to disclose to the federal government, but what has happened more and more frequently is that super PACs are becoming gray money. That money is being filtered through nonprofits, which do not need to disclose their donors, or companies, which are very hard to, you know, actually track down who owns them. And those can actually give to super PACs, so that you can look up who donates money to a super PAC, and their only listed donor is like AB Corporation Inc., which is registered in Delaware, a state that famously has not a lot of restrictions on who can register a corporation. So that's kind of gray money, that it's not quite dark money. We do have some vague idea of who's giving the money, but we don't have a perfect picture. We don't know the name, the occupation, what these people are doing who are actually giving the money.
Hmm. We know that some politicians on the left have sworn off money from super PACs. You know, Bernie Sanders committed to that in his campaigns. Elizabeth Warren did the same in the early part of her recent campaign. But it sounds like more progressive politicians are accepting PACs as part of their reality, when I think sometimes people associate them with the right. Are we seeing signs of this across the board?
Yeah, you know, super PACs are here to stay right now. They're here because of the Citizens United ruling that happened almost a decade ago at this point. But they're here to stay. You know, campaigns, an interesting thing is candidates can say, I don't want a super PAC, and supporters can still set one up. You know, that's where the part of campaigns and super PACs can't coordinate with each other is that somebody could spend money on your behalf. They're called independent expenditures, technically. So they can spend it independently of what you wish. Does that usually happen? No. Normally a super PAC is blessed by a politician saying that this is set up by their former aides or former close staffers, so it's a signal to donors, but that happens too. But even some more progressive groups are starting to register super PACs. Justice Democrats, which is a group that is very famous for backing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the freshman representative from New York, actually just recently registered a super PAC within the last month. That's something that normally jives with their vision of the world, but it's kind of an increasing sign that large money organizations like this are here to stay. Some aides of Senator Sanders set up a super PAC recently, too. Mm-hmm. So they're here to stay. They're here to stay, basically.
All right. Well, then I suspect we'll have many more conversations about this. Zach, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Zach Mondalero is a campaign reporter for Politico. Still ahead on Central Time, we're talking about the newest Marquette poll and how Wisconsin residents feel about the state's stay-at-home order and other current issues. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, small business owners shut down to slow the spread of COVID-19 are trying to figure out what reopening looks like. We're talking to the leader of an organization that's helping answer questions for local businesses free of charge. Right now, the latest Marquette University Law School poll shows a growing divide among Wisconsin residents about how the state is responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. At the end of March, the overwhelming majority supported closing schools, businesses, and restricting public gatherings. Since then, the percentage of people calling those moves an overreaction is growing. It's just one piece of the poll. Results came out today, and we've got the director of the Marquette Law School poll ready to talk about those findings. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Before we dive into those numbers, what do you want people to keep in mind as we're going through them?
Well, I think the big point is that substantial majorities still support the shutdowns of businesses and schools, support the governor's action in dealing with the coronavirus, and in general are more concerned with reopening too soon rather than too slowly. But at the same time, those were super majorities 6 weeks ago in March when we were early on in the epidemic. There is now a growing minority that think we're opening too slow, we want to open sooner. And so partisan divisions have grown a bit over these 6 weeks. But at the same time, majorities are still reluctant to speed the reopening and especially worried that we might reopen too soon and restart the epidemic.
The Evers administration's safer at home order has been in place since the end of March. There's debate about when that order should be lifted, as you said. So what did you find about how people are thinking about the reopening of the state?
Right. Well, first of all, are the closings appropriate or are they an overreaction? A month ago, it was 86 appropriate, 10 overreaction. Today, it's 69 to 26. So that's still a big majority, but you can see more than doubling of the folks that think it's overreacting. When we ask whether you're more concerned that we reopen too slowly or not soon enough, then we get up to about 40% who say they're more concerned that we're not opening soon enough. So that's the kind of divide that we're seeing. But we also see people reluctant to different degrees to go out and resume their normal lives. And so if it's a matter of visiting a friend or a relative in their home, 3/4 of people are willing to do that. If it's a question of going to a ball game or a big group gathering, just 25% are willing to do that. So there's a big range of what we would do even if we reopened tomorrow.
Fewer people say they approve of Governor Evers' handling of the coronavirus as this moves forward. It was 76% who shared their approval in March. Now it's 64%. What should we make of that?
That's the kind of decline that I was pointing to in general. 64% approval is pretty good for any sitting governor, especially in an action like this. But a drop of 12 points shows how much that's beginning to shift. Democrats are still strongly supportive of the governor, but Republicans, who were pretty bipartisan in support of his handling of the virus in March, have now become pretty negative about it. And overall, we've gone from 17% disapproval of how he's handled it to 32% disapproval now. You know, I think as the crisis goes on, we'll see some evening out of his numbers. We also saw President Trump's numbers drop, though. He had 51% approval of coronavirus handling in March. That's fallen to 44% this month. And he's underwater, 44 approve, 51 disapprove. Compare that with the governor's 64 to 32, and you see how big the gap is between evaluations of the governor and of the president. That's something we've seen in almost all other states as well.
Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette Law School poll, and we're talking about the latest results released today, and they focus on the new coronavirus pandemic and also how officials are handling that. And, you know, you've mentioned Evers and also support for President Trump. Overall, Governor Evers' approval rating came in, was it at 59% with 33% disapproving? I know we're in a pandemic, that's so it's fine. Not like normal times, but how does that rate for a second-year governor?
Yeah, well, he was at about 51% approve in February, and he's typically been around 50% or a shade above. So 59 is an increase compared to February, but he was at 65% in March. So again, the initial support for his actions was exceptionally strong. Now it's still quite strong, but it's no longer in the stratosphere that it was a month ago. I think the biggest danger for all elected officials, governors or the president, is do we see clear improvement in the situation in the disease and in the economy over the next 2 or 3 months? Or do we see a resurgence of disease and the economy still collapsing? In that case, I think discontent with all elected officials may start to rise if it looks like we're in a no-win situation. On the other hand, if we reopen and disease doesn't go up, then people will start feeling a lot better, I think. That's just a big gamble as to which will happen if we reopen.
What can you say about the approval or disapproval rating of President Trump's job performance? It sounds like it's been pretty consistent in 2020.
Oh, it's been incredibly consistent. It's down 1 percentage point this month. It was 47-49 this month. It was 48-49 last month. And it has barely moved since January, just a point or two in either direction over the course of these last 4 months. I think that what you're seeing there is his handling of the coronavirus went down 7 points over the month, but his overall job approval just by 1 percentage point. There you see the loyalty and the support that the president has enjoyed for most of his 3 years in office. That gives him a very strong floor, and it did not react nearly as much as the coronavirus handling itself changed. Again, the same story applies over the next 5 months, almost 6 months leading up to Election Day. How do people see the course of the economy and the coronavirus outbreak? And how do they assign credit or blame to the president and to governors and other elected officials as we see what the real course of the disease will be for the next several months?
Yeah. And anything else you just really quick that you want us to take away that we just haven't been able to get to yet in this conversation?
Well, support vote by mail was a big issue in the April election and today's a special election. 36% favor all vote by mail. 57 want to keep what we have now with easy absentee ballots. But over 40% say they themselves will vote by mail in the fall.
Interesting. All right, Charles, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and also director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He is co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. We talked with him today about a poll that is out today, which looks at how Wisconsin residents feel about COVID-19, our elected leaders' response to the pandemic, the race for president, and more. This is Central Time. As the mayor of Flavortown, he's going up against legendary actor Bill Murray and in a nacho building competition. It's called Nacho Average Showdown, and it's for a cause. Viewers are encouraged to chip in to raise money for restaurant workers who need financial help because of COVID-19. Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson is ready to talk about this fierce competition with us. JC, do you have the Nacho Showdown on your calendar for Friday?
I mean, I feel like it just kind of emerged from my dreams. So, of course, I will be following this because basically every person involved feels like, who would have thought to put all of these people in one thing together? But you've got Guy Fieri, Bill Murray, two people I would not have thought about. Then Shaq, so Shaquille O'Neal and Terry Crews. Okay, cool. Also not the first people that would have come to mind. And then Carla Hall, who's hosting it, and it is, to me, just a very interesting group of people. But for lovers of nachos, this sounds kind of awesome.
Right, because they're, like, competing with their sons, right, against one another, and we get to see who, like, somebody's going to win.
Oh, yeah, someone's going to win, and it, of course, it is all for charity, but it is just, like, a very interesting and funny thing that feels like it only happened now. So it just, to me, like, when I first read the story, I was like, wow, this feels like a time and a place sort of charity event.
Absolutely. Thanks, JC. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.